you could shake it out of a salt shaker and put it on your steak.
That's his soil this farmer is talking about, and it's ruined. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
This was before anesthesia, so all of the surgeries were all done on people who were wide awake.
It was hard to come up with something that just wasn't sort of invoking magic.
Then to me, it suggests that the universe is much more about the dark matter than it is about us.
The two-dimensional plane is the dance floor,
we are,
and the
survivors.
Particles are the dancers.
It's a virus that likes to attack lots of different organs.
Unfortunately, the data didn't pan out that way, exactly.
Not as problems to be solved, but as human beings.
On today's show, serious scientific research that involves baking cookies, tons of cookies, an adventure in sensory deprivation, and Maven arrives at Mars. So what's next? But first, back to that salty soil. This is a story about the effects of climate change and sea level rise. And usually, when these topics come up, we're talking about stuff that will or might happen 50 or 100 years from now. But this is about something that's happening right now to one Delaware farmer. Carolyn Beeler reports.
In Milford, across the Delaware Bay from Cape May, farmland runs right up to coastal marshes that border the water. Frank Webb is a farmer here in Kent County. On a sunny late summer day, he wears a pair of blue mirrored sunglasses that seem a near permanent fixture on his weathered face.
This is what we call the Hennessy Farm. We own this, have for many generations.
To Webb's right are tall wetland grasses. To his left, a field of waist-high soybean plants. Between the two, where he's standing, is a swath of bare brown earth the size of a few football fields.
This used to be all farm production land, grew wonderful crops, and it's rendered now just barren. It will not grow any of our crop plants.
The culprit? Salt. Webb's family has been farming this land for five generations, corn and soybeans, wheat and barley. As long as he can remember, salty water from the Delaware Bay has flooded during nor'easters and hurricanes.
That may happen once every 5 or 6 years. And with the continued rainfall throughout the year, it would actually flush the sodium back out of the ground. What I'm saying now is these flood occurrences are happening so frequent, there's no chance for any of this sodium to leach.
He points to the dirt he's standing on, which is tinted white from salt.
If it wasn't for the soil that's in it, you could shake it out of a salt shaker and put it on your steak.
Salt sucks the water out of plant cells, eventually killing the tissue if moisture levels dip low enough. Webb walks over to a lonely, sickly soybean plant growing in a patch of otherwise bare earth. He plucks off a withered leaf that looks burnt.
It'll kind of get a mottling color to it, yellow and green, and then on the ends the tissue dies and turns brown.
Webb says close to 100 of his 1,000 or so tillable acres are now ruined from salt water.
And this continues to get worse every year.
As most people are aware, Delaware is a low-lying state. We have vast expanses of tidal wetlands and coastal plain areas.
That's Susan Love, a planner with the Delaware Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control.
Because of its low-lying elevation and because of issues of subsidence or land sinking, we are particularly vulnerable to the impacts of sea level rise.
Sea level rise is the state's primary climate change concern, as a 2012 vulnerability assessment outlines.
The vulnerability assessment that we conducted showed that up to 11% of Delaware's land mass could be inundated by sea level rise to the year 2100.
Ultimately, low-lying farmlands will be covered in water. But for now, as increasing coastal flooding renders more land too salty for corn and soy, Jack Gallagher is searching for alternative crops for farmers.
What we're trying to do is to come up with ways to maintain the productivity of that land.
Gallagher is an emeritus professor at the University of Delaware. For decades, he's been looking for a salt-resistant crop for coastal farmers.
The plant that we're focusing now primarily is seashore mallow. And what we're doing is taking this plant, which evolved in the brackish wetlands, and we're trying to make it a good crop.
Gallagher takes me into a greenhouse attached to his office and shows me rows of plants in pots.
Well, this is seashore mallow, a perennial.
It usually grows about 5 or 6 feet tall in the wild.
10 or 12 feet tall in the greenhouse here.
It has delicate pink flowers and leaves bigger than your palm, the shape of maple leaves.
Canadians should like it.
Gallagher has been studying this plant for more than 30 years, and he's taken a whole hog approach, trying to figure out how farmers could make money off of every piece of the seashore mallow. He shows me clear test tubes and bottles filled with samples of its various parts.
We have the seeds, and then we have the oil,
which his team has tested as biofuel.
And then we have the meal, which is left over after you take out the oil.
They've used that as rat food.
And then we have the stem material.
They've made that into cat litter and chopped it up into a fluffy white mass,
which we use for poultry bedding.
Gallagher says poultry bedding is the most promising use for the seashore mallow so far. In a study over the winter, he found it was better bedding for chicken coops than standard pine chips. A local farmer has grown seashore mallow for about a decade, and farmers in North Carolina have tried it. There are also plots in China, and this year at a USDA research station in Cape May. But Gallagher hasn't had too much luck convincing new local farmers to try the plant.
When you go to talk to potential growers, immediately they say, well, who's going to buy it? And right now, there isn't anybody to buy it except us. When you go to the person who makes the cat litter, they'll say, who are the suppliers? And so, well, we don't have suppliers now because they won't grow it because there are no people to buy it.
So kind of a chicken and the egg problem.
That's right.
Globally, sea level rise is likely to have an impact on food supplies. Rice farms in the fertile Mekong River Delta in Vietnam have already transformed into vast saline swamps. Nonprofits are working with farmers to change cultivation methods and plant salt-resistant rice strains. Closer to home, Maryland is warning its farmers that increasing salinity may threaten the health of oyster bays. In Delaware, about 23,000 acres of highly productive soil will be underwater if the sea rises a meter, the mid-range projection for the year 2100. All told, less than 10% of farmland in the state is likely to be impacted by sea level rise. Denrec's Susan Love says it's not the top concern for planners.
One of the biggest priorities is wetlands. Up to 99% of our tidal wetlands are at risk of being inundated or permanently flooded by sea level rise. That's fairly huge because a lot of Delaware's economy and quality of life is based on its vast expanses of tidal wetlands.
Delaware is among the most active states in planning for sea level rise, but it doesn't yet have a plan for how to deal with cropland rendered unproductive. Ultimately, Susan Love says farmland will likely be bought for conservation to create a space for wetlands to migrate inland when current habitats are flooded. Although the total acreage of impacted farmland is relatively small on the state level, it's important to those who make their living off the land, farmers like Frank Webb.
When you have less acres that's productive, you're just making less money. It's kind of alarming to see the level that this is occurring.
Webb plans to hand his land over to his two daughters eventually, but he's pushing his grandkids to be doctors or scientists, not farmers.
This ground probably should be diked and flooded for ducks and geese and wildlife and that type thing. It's rendered at this point unproductive to our standard grain crops.
Webb and I drive the few minutes it takes to get from his farmland to the Delaware Bay, where marsh grasses give way to a narrow, sandy beach.
Do you ever think that maybe you shouldn't have a farm so close to the water?
Yes. My forefathers purchased this farm, and if I had have been able to contact them back then, I'd have said, let's move inland, knowing what I know now. No, it's tough.
For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And Carolyn is working on a report on the impact of sea level rise on wetlands in Delaware for a future episode of The Pulse. My personal usage of maps is pretty much limited to the times when I'm staring at my phone where I can oversee a blue dot, that's me, moving from point A to point B. But to the more sophisticated, maps represent a tool to find answers and solutions to big questions. In Philadelphia, almost 400 academic students and programmers are part of the meetup group GeoPhilly. They use geographic data to hack civic problems.
I work for a company called HealthCore down in Delaware. We do medical research for an insurance company.
This week, they got together for pizza and to talk about public health. Sarah Cordovano is one of the organizers.
The Open Data Movement, which is a movement that encourages cities to release a lot of their data sets, gives researchers, citizens, data geeks like myself the opportunity to dig into these data sets. It can be a fun and easy way to try to put the pieces together to solve problems.
For example, Cordovano helped map the cost and time it takes to navigate the city when you've just had a baby and don't have a car.
There's a lot of appointments that women need to go to after they give birth. And if they already have a few kids and don't have childcare, it is very prohibitive for them to attend all those appointments. So it's easy for them to skip the appointments, which certainly has negative effects on the well-being of their baby.
So who would use a map like that?
Well, hopefully policymakers.
She says maps could help city officials decide where to open a new health clinic or suggest that the local food stamp office should be located under the same roof as the neighborhood daycare center. Reporter Tanya English met up with another GeoPhilly member, a map maker who tracks efforts to deal with the city's flooding and polluted water problems.
So green versus gray, right?
It's not really green versus gray. It's green and gray.
Green and gray refers to this. Philadelphia is spending millions to upgrade its aging sewer system, the underground pipes and huge storage tanks that nobody ever sees. Experts call that gray infrastructure. But there's also green improvements happening along the way.
In Philadelphia, when you flush a toilet, run water in the sink, or when it rains, all that water flows to the same set of pipes.
And this is all fine unless it's raining really hard.
Research scientist Michelle Kondo says untreated water backs up in people's basements or overflows into the street. Kondo works for the U.S. Forest Service, but her field station is in the middle of downtown Philadelphia.
Before we had cities and all this pavement and concrete, the earth was pretty good at managing stormwater, right? The rain fell and it was routed, you know, underground or into rivers. And we people have sort of fouled up the system.
Several years ago, the city started greening, adding parks, rooftop gardens, and plants to sop up some of that excess water before it becomes a problem. There are now dozens of green stormwater management projects all across Philadelphia, and Kondo is using maps to figure out if those improvements make a difference to public health.
There's this idea out there that green space is good for us. It helps our mental health. It helps our physical health, our ability to concentrate, bring our stress levels down, and that it is a preventer of crime or our fear of crime. So we have this idea, but largely has been unproven.
Kondo draws a big circle around each site, then adds data on the health of the people who live nearby. From surveys, she can tell which areas have elevated rates of high blood pressure or cholesterol problems. She also maps crime statistics for each neighborhood: assaults, burglaries, drug possession.
So I'm looking at, you know, how many crimes were there in year one, in year two, in year three, in year four. And then the project was built in year four. And then, so how many were there in year five, in year six, in year seven, and so on.
Kondo created a bunch of different maps, then animated them to make a movie.
I will start the movie and you'll be able to see green dots pop up.
As green sites get built, you can watch on the map as red hotspots of narcotics crimes shift. A picture starts to emerge. Over a decade or so, there's as much as 27% fewer narcotics possessions near the green projects, compared to control sites that received no improvements. Paines Park is one of the places that got the green treatment. It's near Martin Luther King Drive, not far from the Art Museum.
This area was known to be a problem area for criminal activity in the city. Let's go look along the fence line to get a feel for what this area looked like before it was transformed.
A couple of years ago, the whole site seemed abandoned with lots of bare earth and construction debris piled up. The skate park and the bike trail are popular, but Kondo brought us here to see a 25-foot trench called a bioswale. It sloped to let rainwater slowly soak into the ground and to prevent surface runoff. Trees and shrubs are planted at the bottom of the trench.
The leaves and the root system of these plants play an important role in what we call intercepting the rainwater.
Each species was specially picked, but Kondo can't exactly say what kind of plants these are.
I don't know. I'm sorry. I'm not an arborist or even a landscape architect.
Or a forest ranger.
No.
She is a map maker and a data cruncher who says this about Philadelphia's green improvements.
Now we can say there are also public health benefits as well.
Is that public health benefit or is that a public safety benefit?
I would say that safety and crime count as public health.
Kondo didn't find strong evidence that urban green projects reduce people's stress or drive down blood pressure. But she says green improvements do signal that the community cares about a place.
Criminal activity will not be tolerated in these spaces.
Even if you're not convinced that reducing crime counts as improving health, Kondo's a believer. And federal health officials seem invested, too. The mapping project is partly funded by the National Institutes of Health. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
To see the movie map of green stormwater management sites across Philadelphia, go to whyy.org/thepulse. Coming up on The Pulse, there is no shortage of bass player jokes.
Wait a minute, aren't you the bass player? Why are we even talking to you?
Shouldn't you be, like, unloading equipment or something?
Don't you need to put some water bottles on the stage?
Don't you have to, like, steam their costumes?
Bass is the foundation of the band!
Yes, it is, and we have the science to prove it.
Because you know I'm all about that bass, no trouble.
That's coming up next on The Pulse here on WHYY.
I'm all about that bass, no trouble. I'm all about that bass, bass.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. We're going to play a little game right now. Name that tune. Not coming to you? I know you know this song. I know you know it. Here is a big hint.
Brother, 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 there's far too many of you die.
What's Going On has a great melody, great lyrics, and it's really memorable.
To bring some loving here today,
All right, now that you have Marvin Gaye stuck in your head, it is worth thinking about that bass line again, its role in the song. If we didn't recognize it right away, why is it even there? Does our ear hear it differently? Todd Bookman has been exploring these questions.
Laurel Trainor plays the flute, clearly not the instrument of breakdowns and sweaty dance floors. But in her side role as a neuroscientist, she also works with sound, trying to better understand human reaction to it. She's at the McMaster Institute for Music and the Mind in Ontario, Canada, and her latest project revolves around the basic structure of song.
Well, one of the things about music composed around the world is that the higher-pitched instruments tend to carry the melody line, and the lower-pitched instruments tend to lay down the rhythm.
take a spin across the dial, from Indonesia to Brazilian samba, Afrobeat to rock, Delta blues, jazz. The beat, the groove, is almost always carried by lower range instruments. This may seem obvious that it's just the way that a song sounds best, but Trainer wanted to do an experiment to figure out why. What's happening in our bodies that tells us it's good musically to structure things this way? So she had participants come into her laboratory, 7 males, 10 females, some with musical training, some without. And she put what looks like a hairnet on their heads. The device is dotted with electrodes.
And this allows us to measure the electrical fields that your brain is generating when you're going to listen to the sounds we present. And now we're going to turn on the sounds, and what we're going to do is play two notes at the same time, and this is going to repeat over and over again, and occasionally we're going to make changes in those sounds.
So this is a G below middle C, and a B flat played an octave and a bit above that. And every few beats, one is played 50 milliseconds before the other. It's a subtle shift.
And what we're interested in knowing is when we make perturbations, if we change one of the timings of those notes, is your brain going to respond more if we change the timing of the low note, or is it going to respond more if we change the timing of the high note?
That is, which mistakes in the rhythm does the brain react more strongly toward? Which bothers us more when played off beat? The answer was pretty clear.
The brain responded more when we changed the timing of the low notes than when we changed the timing of the high notes. And that is probably why we put the rhythm in the lower pitched instruments, because our brains are just better at picking up that timing information.
These results were recently published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Trainer and her colleagues also played the same offbeat piano sounds through a computer model of the ear. And it was right there, within the inner ear, in the cochlea, where the response originated, suggesting our bodies are built to hear like this. It isn't just something we grow used to through repetition.
It's less a function of learning. It's not just that we've listened to a lot of music with the bass in the carrying out the rhythmic function, but it's actually in the physiology of our ear that we hear that way.
Trainer says there are some theories for why this is, why humans evolved this way, and it doesn't have much to do with music. Picture our early ancestors out alone in the woods. Hearing was about survival, about hunting and being hunted and protecting the young.
It really evolved in order to figure out what objects are in the environment and where they're located.
Higher pitch noises, like a baby's cry or an animal's call, are placed at a premium. The lower sounds add an additional layer of information, not just what something is, but where it is. Is it coming closer or retreating? Today, the way we hear music may be a direct result of that early survival mechanism. To learn more, not just about how we hear, but how songwriters use rhythm to build a sound, I stopped by Philadelphia's Curtis Institute of Music and caught up with David Ludwig.
Well, I'm a composer, a contemporary classical music composer. It's not an oxymoron.
Ludwig is a celebrated composer. He's done pieces for orchestras, Hollywood film scores, and he also teaches composition at the school.
So when you sit down to compose or an idea comes to you, I'm curious, is it the rhythm that you need to lay down first, or is it a melody that sort of inspires you and then you work around that? Which way does it come?
Creativity really comes from the unconscious mind, and so there's not a lot of order up there, and things just kind of pop in, and if you're lucky enough to receive it, you just jot it down. So sometimes it's a bass line, sometimes it's a melody, sometimes it's a sound, sometimes it's a topic.
Ludwig says one of the most famous 19th century composers, Frédéric Chopin, provides perfect examples for how songwriters balance rhythm and melody. One of Ludwig's students, George Fu, is going to play for us now. He's picked out a piece called Polonaise in F-sharp minor, Opus 44. But instead of playing it as written, Fu is first going to move his left hand much farther over to the right side of the piano, much closer to his right hand. This shift moves the rhythm out of the lower tones.
And now let's hear it as Chopin wrote it to really hear the strength of the rhythm set in the lower frequencies. I think it just hits you in the gut, you know? It reaches out and grabs you, that rhythm, and you hear it so much more strongly because it's in the lower end of our hearing.
Ludwig and Professor Laurel Trainer say that for music to really catch in your ear, whether it's a classical piece or top 40, it needs both the lows and the highs working together. That the bass, when done right, is like scaffolding for the melody, holding it up. Even if it's often not the most memorable part of a song, without the rhythm, the song probably wouldn't be worth remembering. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
Let's take a short moonwalking intermission, and for some quick insight into how much music video production has changed in the past years, do watch the Billie Jean video. Those light-up squares, they were super high-tech. Who would dance on the floor? So whatever the it song was when you were a kid, chances are, even if you haven't heard it in forever, you still know all the words, right? Music and memory are deeply linked in the brain. And music therapists find that for the elderly, music from earlier times doesn't just help them socialize and relax. If they have dementia, it can also help orient their minds to the present by connecting with who they were in the past. Laura Benchoff sends this postcard from a music therapy session at New Cortland Life, a senior day center in North Philadelphia.
Well, we mixed a little bit of gospel and a little bit of Motown for you girls and guys. You guys seem to like that kind of stuff. If you have any requests and I haven't played them, just shout them all out. We'll do them. If I don't know them, I'm going to make it up. It's going to be a new experience for all of us.
I am Jerry O'Leary. I'm a music therapist for MusicWorks. We do a one-hour music therapy session for the seniors, and we're trying to encourage them to boost their self-confidence, give them a chance to interact with one another, socialize with one another all through music.
This song everybody knows. Nobody knows who wrote it. It's one of those anonymous songs. But everybody knows who made it famous. Who made When the Saints Go Marching In famous?
Satchmo.
You have to play what they want to hear. That's called client-preferred music, and that's really one of the magic ingredients in music therapy. Because that takes them back to a time when things were younger, simpler, and a lot more fun.
My name is Agena Shaw. I'm the Therapeutic Recreation Coordinator here at New Cortland Life Program. During this time when they're in this room, their mood changes, especially with our folks who have either dementia or, you know, memory impairment. They remember the songs. So at that time, they feel, you know, comfortable. They're able.
There's a lady, little lady named Gloria, and she's so quiet. And she's, what you might say, special. She was singing today.
My name is Paul Nolan. I'm the retired director of music therapy programs at Drexel University. Someone who's 85 has 85 years of music education. They still know how music goes. Music cognition seems to be preserved. And why is that? Because it's perhaps our oldest cognition. Mothers never talk like this. Yes, you are very cute, and it's fun playing with you. You know, they'll go, "You're so cute." You know, rhythm, you know, padding, and the kid knows he's one with the mom now. Those are pre-musical. Those are elements we use, you know, in music.
We're going to sing along with you.
Favorite instrument.
This is your favorite instrument,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
Put this hand up here so that, there you go, that's okay. The way to do it. You okay like that?
Yes.
And you're just going to strum.
It's not a guitar.
You got
it. We want them to feel good about the things they can do because there's so many things they draw into that they can't do. I can't do this anymore, I can't do this anymore. But I can, yeah, but you can play these tubes, or you can play this drum, or you can play this cue chord. Then all of a sudden, yeah, I can. They start believing it much better.
You'll see somebody who was a carpenter for 50, 60 years, and you hand the person a hammer, and the person won't know what it is. But that person will tell you if you're playing Swanee River too fast.
My name is Brother Mike Wilkerson, and I'm from the Alani section.
I had a stroke and things like that, and you know, I really appreciate it because it helps me. It helps me get my life together, it helped me get better.
I once was lost, but
Music, just like sex, drugs, and now rock and roll, affects our nucleus accumbens and our basal ganglia, which is the pleasure zone. So when that happens, it affects the amygdala. The amygdala calms down. It sends messages to the prefrontal cortex of like, do what you have to do to keep this going.
My name is Yvonne Brown. I've been here 6 years. When I first came here, I was depressed. I joined the choir. That gave me an uplifting spirit and gets me going through the day. And I love my choir members. We all give each other support.
The music is the therapy. You know, I'm the facilitator. You know, and they're doing the therapy, and I'm just leading it.
Laura Benchoff produced this piece. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse. Things got really busy around the red planet this week. The Mars Atmosphere and Volatile Evolution, or MAVEN, spacecraft entered orbit around the planet on Monday morning. India's Mars Orbiter mission followed on Tuesday night. Joining us now to talk about these missions is Joe Gwynn of NASA. He is manager of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory's Mission Design and Navigation Section. Joe, thank you so much for being on The Pulse.
Glad to be here.
Joe, how are the two missions different from one another?
Well, let's see. The MAVEN, the NASA spacecraft, is really going to be in a much lower, tighter orbit. And its intention is to study the upper atmosphere of Mars. And it kind of, to do that, flies sort of pole to pole. The Indian spacecraft goes around the equator. It's in a much longer period orbit. And you know, largely, I think the goal of the Indian was more technology to get into orbit. They do have some science, but the goal of the NASA mission is primarily science.
Now, something we've been reading about is the comparative cost of the two missions. India spent about $74 million. The USA spent over $600 million on the mission. Where does that difference in cost come from?
Well, I'm sure that there's some economic factors that may come into play there. I think we keep in mind that the NASA mission, its focus is on the science, and to have a complete year of doing science activities, and then also the processing and the after the mission looking and evaluating the science, those are all factored in. And there is sort of an afterlife of the MAVEN vehicle. We carry a separate little radio that allows it to perform as a relay so that other vehicles that land on Mars, they don't have to carry a big honking antenna to communicate directly to Earth. They can actually communicate through this orbiter. So that's another reason the cost for the NASA mission would be a little bit higher.
And how long will MAVEN stay?
So its primary mission is one Earth year to do its science. The vehicle is built to last, and we actually, the same company, Lockheed Martin, who built MAVEN, also built a couple of other orbiters that are still there. And one of them was arrived in 2001. So, you know, they tend to have some longevity, and we hope to see the same for MAVEN.
And then what happens with MAVEN after that year is over?
Well, they might get some extended time to do more science. Often that happens. If it is needed, if it makes sense. But otherwise, it really turns into this relay asset to provide these communication services to other future Mars missions.
So it'll stay where it is.
Right. And we do have a requirement to make sure that it can stay there and not go crashing into the planet for 50 years. That's a planetary protection requirement on us. Just to make sure that if we had carried any bugs, we wouldn't be taking them down onto the planet. And it has to, it eventually would potentially decay and then crash into Mars, but that'll be after 50 years. There are pristine places on Mars, and if there were any kind of life or biologic activity, we'd like to not have found it because we actually brought it there ourselves, right? So we're trying to keep all the bugs off of Mars as long as we can.
And what are the primary goals? Give us some examples of the things you want to find out.
Right. So, you know, there's a great mystery in our solar system about how Mars evolved from, you know, potentially being this water abundant, possibly life supporting world, but to what it is today. It's kind of a desolate, freezing cosmic desert, I guess you call it. So the MAVEN has these sensors that are designed to allow or to sample the upper atmosphere, the upper reaches of the atmosphere, to search for remnants of maybe water molecules that are slowly escaping from Mars. In the past, we've sent orbiters or other missions to study the surface of Mars. Here, we're studying the very upper reaches of the atmosphere to try to understand the process of why that atmosphere is so thin. I think many people don't know that the atmosphere is only about 1% of the Earth's atmosphere. So what happened to it if there was one in the past? And if there's something process that's causing that, could that happen to Earth? And is there something we could do about it?
And to you, what makes up the allure of Mars?
Well, it's probably the unknown and the fact that it's probably the closest thing, other planet to us that if we needed a place to go live, well, there that would be where we would go. So I think that's probably a big part of it.
Joe Gwynn, thank you so much for being on The Pulse.
Thank you.
Joe Gwynn of NASA is manager of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory's Mission Design and Navigation Section. Coming up on The Pulse, we try out sensory deprivation.
They're called escape pod tanks. There's no light, there's no sound, and the water is kept to skin temperature so that you can't even feel it. So you're not receiving any sensory input whatsoever when you're inside the tank.
That's next on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Stress is bad for us. Study after study has shown the terrible impact it has on our hearts, digestion, sleep, concentration, and on. But life is hectic. It's loud, and it's hard to find your zen. A new business in the Fishtown section of Philadelphia wants to offer an escape.
My name is Carrie Lynn Rikikis, and I am the owner of Halcyon Floats in Philadelphia.
When you enter Halcyon Floats, it looks a bit like a new agey cafe where you could get a cup of detox tea and perhaps buy some crystals or something. But then Rikikis takes me into an area that looks like a spa treatment room with a strange addition.
They're called escape pod tanks. They look a little bit scientific from the outside.
Honestly, more like an oversized black coffin.
So we have a tank, it's about 9 by 5. Inside the tank is 10 inches of water. Inside that water is dissolved 850 pounds of Epsom salt, which makes you completely buoyant, so you float without any effort. There's no light, there's no sound, and the water is kept to skin temperature so that you can't even feel it. So you're not receiving any sensory input whatsoever when you're inside the tank.
So now you're perhaps thinking Altered States, right? That freaky, drug-laden 1980s movie with William Hurt. It's not supposed to be like that. Just quiet, dark, and buoyant.
Once you're inside the tank, it's very spacious. Once the lights are out, it feels as if you're in a huge expanse of space. It feels like you're in outer space almost.
So I'm at Halcyon Floats to try this out, obviously, but just looking at the tank has activated my inner phobes. First up, the germaphobe.
How do you keep the water clean, or how is it maintained?
It's a filtration system that we run between floats three times, and every drop of water gets pulled through that filtration system and filtered through. And attached to that filtration system is also a UV sterilizer, so the water is also getting sterilized.
Next up, claustrophobia. What if I can't stand being in that tank?
A lot of people have apprehensions when they hear there's a door on there, but it's very simple. It's just hinged. There's no locks or latches.
And I can take a little floating light inside with me. Typically, a float takes about 90 minutes. First, you have to get a shower, so I get a plush towel, slippers, and also earplugs.
Gonna take my little light. It's on. I have my earplugs in. I can't hear a thing. But I'm gonna try this. Okay.
All right, I'm going in. Ooh, slippery.
The floating part is fun, being completely weightless. I bounce from one side to the other a bit, but as the novelty of that sensation wears off, as your eyes adjust to the dark, your brain starts to feel deprived of input, and it goes a little bit into overdrive.
The water is kind of nice. I can see the scenery.
I wonder, what am I going to have for dinner tonight?
A little bit of music.
I don't know. Does chicken go bad? Chicken goes bad.
Did I send that email?
Quickly. Did I put the pulse promo in?
Oh my God, that's supposed to air tomorrow. I totally forgot. I need to text Meg. I need to text. Right, right. I did put it in. I put it in. Okay. My knee feels kind of funny. It's helping my foot though. My foot. I can stretch out my foot. Whew, I wonder how long it's been. It's probably been like 45 minutes. I wish they had an alarm clock in here. I gotta email Philip for his birthday. Yeah, that's coming up, right?
Yeah.
I hate skirts.
Yep.
Does your brain ever stop thinking? Does the brain ever stop thinking? What am I thinking about? When you're trying to think about what you're thinking about, then my ears can't think of it. That's weird. I go deaf.
This is the pulse.
Can't go deaf. Then I can't do my work. If I go deaf, I can't work at all. What would I do if I went deaf? That'd be crazy. I would not work in radio anymore. And I don't know what to do. I mean,
I'm Mike.
Thank you for listening.
I'm Mike.
All right. Focus on the breath.
Thank you for listening.
And direct your thoughts to the breath. I felt a little funny. What if you? Okay, I can always climb out. I can always climb out.
Eventually, I do experience brief moments of meditative bliss, but it's as if I just can't let go. Afterwards, Halcyon Float's owner, Carolyn Rikikas, and I debrief.
So how do you feel?
I feel good. I struggled kind of, I guess, with settling into the experience, which I'm sure people do the first time around.
In general, it takes a little bit of practice. Your first float, you fidget around in there, you just touch the walls, play with the water. Once you're in there for a while, you finally do let go. And then it's like the second and third float where you come in and it's just like clockwork. You're completely unplugged when you're inside the tank. You don't have to worry about your phone. If you're going to muddle over your issues, you're in there to solve them.
Rikika says floating also helps people who are recovering from injuries and are dealing with chronic pain because the weightless experience helps them stretch and relax their muscles. And she told me, to really get it, to really become a floater, I have to try it again. We'll see. You're listening to The Pulse, and after all that sensory deprivation, it seems like some baked goods are in order, right? Joining us now is regular Pulse contributor Dr. Bethany Brookshire. She is a writer for Science News and Society for Science and the Public. Hi, Bethany.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you. You're currently doing a project called Cookie Science. What is that?
It's actually for the educational blog that I write for called Eureka Lab. And the goal is to actually show people that doing a scientific experiment is just as close as your kitchen. You just have to walk into your kitchen and ask yourself a question and find a scientific way to answer it. And so I'm doing cookie science. I am designing a series of experiments designed around cookies and I'm carrying them out publicly on the blog. I'm documenting everything I do with photos. All of the stuff that I use is stuff that you can buy in the grocery store. And I'm making a lot of cookies, testing a lot of cookies on a lot of lucky people who get to eat cookies. And I'm hoping that my readers will actually follow along and bake the cookies and see if they can replicate my results.
So give me an example of one of the experiments that you would do during your... This is just an excuse for cookie baking, right?
I wish it was an excuse for cookie baking, but cookie baking would be a lot easier, actually.
All right. So give me an example. Give me an example of what you do. What's an experiment?
So my goal throughout this project for Cookie Science, I have a really amazing cookie recipe. It's one of my favorite cookie recipes. It's actually Alton Brown's Chewy recipe, if you've ever tried it.
Mm-hmm.
It's really delicious. And I want to share my cookies with my friends. Unfortunately, one of my friends, Natalie, she has celiac disease, a disease that means whenever she eats gluten, which is a protein found in wheat, her immune system attacks her intestine. So I would like to make my cookies into a recipe so that she can eat them. And that's a goal, but it's not a testable hypothesis. So for my first experiment, I actually read a bunch of scientific papers looking at wheat gluten and how it works. I compared a bunch of regular cookie recipes with a bunch of gluten-free recipes. And I actually designed a hypothesis that states that replacing wheat flour with gluten-free flour in my cookie recipe will not be enough to create a good cookie.
Hmm.
And so I'm actually testing it out. I'm making several batches of cookies. One of them will be my control. It will be the normal Alton Brown recipe. One of them will have a kind of gluten-free flour, and that will be the only change. And then I'm going to give my cookies to a bunch of people, and I'm going to ask them what they think. I'm taking a survey. And so my goal is, through a series of experiments, to create a cookie that is as much like my control cookie as possible without containing gluten.
And how many people do you have to enroll in your cookie study as taste testers to make sure your results are really happening?
Well, that's another thing I'm actually looking at with Cookie Science. I'm going through and saying, okay, with a power analysis, which is a statistical measure, how do I know how many people I need to test my cookies on? Unfortunately, the power analysis says that for a large population, I need to test my cookies on about 200 people. I don't have access to that many people.
Oh, we can make that happen.
But right now, I'm trying to test my cookies in real time. I recruited my neighborhood. I recruited the people at work. And I have had them eat my cookies. And so far, I've had about 40 people try the cookies for the first experiment.
And how do you account for people's different tastes? So one person might say, this is a delicious cookie. And I might say, this is not delicious at all. That's another scientific question, right?
That's a very good question. So I don't actually ask people, hey, tell me if this cookie is delicious. Instead, I ask a series of questions using what's called a Likert scale. So with a Likert scale, you make a statement. And the statement is something like, this cookie is moist. And then the person has to rate on a measure of 1 to 5. They very much agree, this cookie is very moist. 2, they very much disagree, this cookie is not at all moist. And so I ask questions like, is the cookie moist? Is the cookie dry? Is the cookie sweet? And so I have all these different measures of different aspects of my cookies. And then at the end, the statement is, overall, I like this cookie. And they can agree or disagree. And so this allows me to look at the results and say, okay, overall, these cookies were more dry, more moist, more sweet. And then it allows me to separate those aspects out from whether or not people liked the cookie.
Wow. So this is a lot of work.
It is. I actually wrote a full scientific proposal. I got institutional review board approval to test on human subjects. I did the whole deal.
And your friend is perhaps saying, you know what, Bethany, I could have just gone to the bakery and bought a gluten-free cookie, but thanks.
So far, she's been very nice about it and very patient. I've promised that in a few months, she will have her cookie.
Bethany, thank you so much for being on The Pulse.
Thank you so much for having me.
regular Pulse contributor Bethany Brookshire of Science News. She writes for the educational blog Eureka Lab, and that's where she will be posting all these great cookie recipes and her cookie science findings.
Now, what starts with the letter C?
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, and Alana Gordon. Gray Tennis is our intern. And a big congratulations to our engineer, Charlie Kyer, who's about to say I do to Emily Gunther. He's getting married this weekend. Joel Patterson is our associate producer, Megan Pinto, the executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. If you miss some of this show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. That way you can listen to The Pulse anytime. And we always love to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.